This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to the final week of Conversations for 2018. And you've got both of us all this week. Me, Richard Feidler.
And me, Sarah Kanoski.
And we're bringing you the best, our most favourite, best-looking human beings we had on the program all of this year.
And who's today?
Today, it's Jenny Briscoe-Huff. Jenny is a community worker in Port Kembla in the Illawarra region in New South Wales. And Jenny and a group of people have pioneered this whole idea of community funerals, Sarah. They don't believe in outsourcing death. They've brought it back home.
I love this conversation. I'm so glad we're hearing it again.
I spoke to Jenny in February. Just south of Wollongong is the industrial suburb of Port Kembla. Jenny Briscoe-Huff manages the community centre there. Since Jenny took over, it's become a real hive of activity. There's a very successful men's group. There's a sewing for zero waste group. There are meditation workshops, gardening, permaculture groups, that kind of thing. But there's another thing they do that at first glance seems unlikely for a community centre. Jenny and her colleagues run a not-for-profit funeral service. And this was the subject of a beautiful documentary from a few years back called Tender. In times gone by, the process for washing and preparing a body for a funeral and for conducting the service was traditionally managed by the family. And this was considered a great honour at the time. And it seemed to help hugely with the grieving process. But somehow, over the last 100 years or so, we've managed to outsource this business. And now we've come to think of keeping the body out of sight as normal. Jenny Briscoe-Huff now wants to help people in her community and others take back the control of dealing with their dead, to bring the dead back home. That's a nice way of putting it, I hope. Hello, Jenny.
Hello, Richard.
This idea starts with your mum in 2007 when your mum died. Tell me what happened when you went about organising your mum's funeral, Jenny.
Look, I think what happened really was that we just went along sort of a road that was already set out, and we just followed the road and we did what we were supposed to do. And, we didn't ask questions, that many questions. We didn't ask prices.
Because that seems vulgar.
There's no prices on things. It's like, we just went along. We didn't have many choices. We didn't think we had many choices. But we did do as much as we could. You know, my mum was that sort of person who, you know, wouldn't want us to spend a lot of money. So we didn't have, just one hearse, and my sister-in-law did the flowers and I did the eulogy, and we designed the memorial cards ourselves, and we did go and wash and dress her. I think we didn't ask questions really, which was a bit shocking.
Yeah, because you like to ask questions normally, don't you?
I do. I mean, I'm pretty bolshy, actually, and I do ask questions. So, yeah, I do like to ask questions.
So how did you feel when you got the bill?
Well, I was horrified when we got the bill, but I think I was more horrified by the fact that the funeral home had put its advertising on my mother's memorial card. And I was like, I sort of suddenly woke up. You know, so we, but I was horrified by the bill because we had done a lot. We already owned the burial plot and we still got a bill for over nearly $10,000. And I was like, oh my God, how did that happen? And also I think my mother would have been horrified by that sort of cost.
Did you imagine her giving you a stern
well,
talking
look,
to her?
My mother liked to bargain in David Jones, so she would have been like, what have I done wrong? I've done something wrong. These children have not asked the right questions. They've like, and in a way, we didn't ask the right questions, you know. So it was really it was shocking, but it also didn't make sense.
Port Kembla is a steel town, and there's quite a few people who are long-term unemployed there. Have you heard stories before in your work about the cost of funerals and not being able to afford the funeral?
Yeah. So we run a no-interest loan scheme as well, and people did come in and try and get loans for funerals. I think it was like a moment where things just all lined up in a way that we had somebody in our community also die, and, there were difficulties around paying for that, and also there's difficulties with people leaving the community after they die, like so the families reclaim their people. And there is a community there that is sort of left then without that, because in our community there's a lot of families that are estranged, a lot of people who are estranged from their families because they've got either drug and alcohol issues or mental health issues. But there is a community there. They are in community. And so there's a couple of things that happen when people die. One is that they can't you know, people can't afford that. And the other thing is that people don't necessarily get to be part of the process because, you know, the whole idea of somebody belonging, who belongs to that person who's died.
Yeah, there's that moment where I think you might have that thought, gee, I wish there was a better way. And then the next moment, which is, let's do it ourselves.
Yes,
well, that's a big jump, I think. So how did you reach that point?
Well, I think really it was like a moment. I mean, my friend Lynette and me were talking about it and it was like, oh, you know, it was a conversation. You know, it was like, oh, this seems like it could be a good thing for to do a social enterprise about. It was really like a thought. And then I brought it up at a board meeting or a committee meeting and I said, oh, you know, I've been thinking about this thing and maybe we should do a not-for-profit funeral service. And suddenly everybody in the room was sort of on their feet and really very excited.
Really? Yeah, right.
They were really excited.
They went, yes, did they?
They went, you know, somebody said, I want us to bury me. And I
want us to bury me.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then it occurred to me that not everyone did have someone who was going to look after them. And so I was sort of the only person sitting down at that point, and I was a bit like, oh, okay. Because I didn't know what we were going to do. I didn't know how to do that. I didn't have any idea how to do that. But we made a decision to look into it, and so we looked into it. And we decided that we would have a go, really. I mean, that's what you do when you don't know what you don't know, basically.
So how did you begin to find out what you didn't know?
I did some research and I tried to find people because, the thing is you don't even know where to look when you don't know. So I tried to find people who I thought might have a similar sensibility. And in the end, I found Jerry Grace Lyons, who was in America, and she was running a sort of home funerals community based thing there, and she was offering training. So I went to America and I did some training with her, and then I went to another place in Totnes, a funeral home called Greenfuse, and I did some training with them. And they, what was beautiful about them was that they had a sort of shop in the main street that sold coffins, and so people would come into that shop and organize their funerals. And so I spent quite a bit of time in that shop, and people would come in and say, I've walked past this shop like 70 times and today I've come into the shop. So there was something about the presence of coffins in a main street that makes people think, and that brings something that's hidden out of being hidden that's interesting and helpful. But the best thing really was that Jerry Grace Lyons told me about Zenith Virago, who actually is in Byron Bay. And
Zenith who?
Virago.
Oh, Zenith Virago.
Yeah.
Not her. The name she was born with, clearly, but nonetheless.
No. So she has this extraordinary person, and she's been sort of at the forefront of this sort of alternative funeral movement now for a really long time.
And what was she able to teach you about this?
Well,
process?
She just,
in terms of the legality of all of this.
Yeah, she taught me everything. She said, I rang her, I think I sent her an email and she was in Bali surfing or something, and she said, when I come back, come and see me. Or maybe I picked, anyway, we met and we immediately really liked each other. And I picked her up from the airport and I drove her to Bowral. We had this big conversation in the car, and then she said, come to Byron and I'll tell you. And so I just spent 5 days in Byron with her, and she told me, she ran me through everything I needed to know, really, which was sort of amazing because knowing it doesn't mean you can actually do it, but knowing it was fantastic.
Is it actually legal for non-professionals to prepare and wash a body before a funeral service?
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. There's very little that's not legal. Like it's not about, there's a lot of things that are legal. You are allowed to keep a body at home for up to 5 days. You are.
Really? That's quite legal?
That's legal, yeah. Yeah. If in an expected death. So in an unexpected death, you have to call the coroner or, you know, find out what's happened to that person. But in an expected death, you can keep the body at home for up to 5 days. And even, one of the things about even in an unexpected death, if you find somebody and that has died, if your partner has died during the night and it's unexpected, but obviously nothing wrong has happened, they've died. So
and nothing can be done.
Nothing can be done.
To rescue.
Nothing can
situation.
Be done. So there's a whole lot of things around even that, around keeping, you know, I think not immediately calling anybody. You know, Zenith always says, you know, what you should do is pick up the kettle, not the telephone, and just have your time with that person. Because often when someone dies like that, people pick up the phone and then that person's taken away and then...
And that's it. That's it.
You never see them again. No. So there's a whole lot of learning to go on, a whole lot of sort of culture changing around what is possible to do and what is our default position around it. What is our response to these things that happen?
It seems like there's a kind of a... Is it a natural thing? I don't know. But there's a kind of a squeamishness barrier that you have to travel through or climb over to get to the other side. And you're pretty happy once you get to the other side. But you've got that squeamishness barrier. I feel it. I mean, I think most people do.
Yeah. Look, I think it's true. But I think it's really like it's in your mind. It's what you imagine. And what we imagine is often so much worse than the reality of something. So, you know, even now what we would – I think it's fear. I think there's been a whole lot of, you know, mystery created around it, but actually it's very simple. And you know, we have got I always say to people when they're about to come into the mortuary and they feel a bit anxious, you know, you're about 5 minutes away from not being afraid, because the thing about fear is that if you just stay in fear, you stay afraid. But if you move through fear, then you're not afraid anymore. If you go and do the thing that you're worried about. And I see that all the time, that people walk into the mortuary and they're like, oh, and there's their person. There's their person. And, of course, they know how to care for that person.
I've certainly found that the first instinct you have is not to recoil, but to rush to the body and give it a hug and a kiss.
Yes. I think that's true. People,
it's funny,
because people, because they recognise that person. You know, that person is that person, and so really, it's a very, what happens is that the love they have comes forward, and so it's not complex. It's not a complex thing, and all of a sudden, all of those images that they imagined, even when the death's been like traumatic, you know. Even in those instances, it can be really great for people to come in and look after that person.
I mentioned that documentary Tender that came out a few years ago that focused on this whole, how you got this up and running. And at the centre of it was the death of a really much loved member of your community, a man named Nigel, who was the caretaker of your centre, who's so deeply loved by people. Even though he wasn't a man of many words, he's a very, very quiet man. And the moment when all of you as a group and his brother take part in cleaning his body is so incredibly powerfully moving. What did you learn that going through that process of doing that for someone that you really cared greatly for, in the case of Nigel?
Look, I think the thing that you realise is that physical body is a loved physical body, you know. So the thing I think we learned was that caring for that person really helped us in that process of coming to terms with the fact that he had died. And something happens, I think, when you put your hands on the body of somebody who you love and care about, who has died, is that your body sort of gets a message from that. It's like a, I don't know what it's called, it's like maybe a mnemic sort of memory. Something happens in the body so that your body somehow understands that that person has died.
Yes, that's it, isn't it?
Yeah. And so something happens so that there's, I don't know that there's less longing, but there's certainly something in you goes, oh.
Acceptance.
Well, I don't know if that's acceptance, but it's knowledge.
Yeah.
It's a knowledge. It's a physical knowing. And so that's helpful, I think.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. It's not it's not even an understanding. It's a knowledge.
It's a knowledge.
That's suddenly imparted. And there's something very... Is it satisfying? Not satisfying. I don't know what to explain it is, but there seems to be something very helpful in that.
Well, anyway. I think what happens is then that the body sort of can understand that, and you know, the body's intelligent, and the body then can help with that understanding and that processing of that longing, that physical longing, or that, you know, I mean, I have that with my mother as well, you know, because you have a longing for that, you know, put your head on that person's shoulder, or and then something in that goes, right, that person's not there
And it's the same, but it's different.
It's the same, but it's different. So it's, I think, unless we participate in some of those, I mean, rituals happen because they're helpful usually. We do things in, you know, someone doesn't just make them up. You know, human beings have always cared for their dead. So if we don't do that, it's almost like we are in some way denying ourselves something that could help us. Although it's absolutely a choice. People don't want to, that's absolutely fine. But I do think it's how we hold things culturally, you know, so, yeah.
Jenny, there's in that moment too where you see people preparing Nigel, I think you always worry that you won't know what to do, but maybe it's that spark of instant knowledge that's imparted to you that gives you a grace.
Yeah.
And you do know what to do, it seems.
Yeah, absolutely. I've never seen anybody in the mortuary who doesn't know what to do. They do know what to do. And often what happens, and that's what happens, people say, oh, can you come in with me and help me? And so we would often start there. We'll go in you know, we'd have a process where we're just stepping back. Until we're like, oh, are you right then? They're like, yeah, we got it. We're right. And they call us in if they need a physical help with something.
And afterwards, do people just really need to talk to you about this whole experience? Afterwards, they go, oh, my God, I didn't think it was going to be like that at all. And it was amazing. Is that what happens?
Not everybody. Some people feel so, there's a lot of joy in it. And some people just feel like, you know, they just did the thing they wanted to do, and it's a private thing. I mean, one thing that's very interesting that we've worked out is that some people just want to come in and they want no one to help them, and that's often the partner of somebody who's died, who's been sometimes through a long medical procedure, and that process is a reclaiming of the body, actually. It's like that person's been looked after by doctors and nurses, and those people sometimes will come in, they'll go, I don't want anyone to help me. Like, you know, I want to do, this is my person and I'm going to do it. And there's so much to be said for that. When you see somebody do that, it's so, you know, it makes complete sense. Of course it makes complete sense, but they want to do that thing themselves. They don't want to open it up to all the friends and the relatives. They're like, nah, they can't come in. So people have their own reasons for doing those things, but no one's ever come out going, that was terrible. You know, people are usually coming out feeling pretty happy. And, you know, we also have children in the mortuary, coming into the mortuary, and they also, you know, they seem relieved by that.
Now, this all starts with your mum and what happened after your mum had her funeral. Tell me a bit about your mum. What memories do you have from your childhood around the home?
Oh, she was pretty funny. She was a great woman, my mum. She was a hairdresser. And she had like a backyard hairdressing room she had. I wouldn't call it a salon. It was a hairdressing room. And so our house was like filled with women getting their hair done from like 5 a.m. In the morning till 10 a.m. at night. And my mother had this great, incredible strategy that she was just going to put them all to work. You know, so they were like vacuuming the house and putting the clothes on the line, and they'd be under the hairdryer doing our hems. Their faces would be bright red and they'd say, oh, Rose, I think I've... am I dry yet? And Mum would like, look how much hem they've got. No, you just got a bit more. You know, she was really, but you know, the thing
so,
is.
So, hang on, so women would come in to get their hair cut.
Yeah.
But they'd be in there all day.
All day.
All day. Right.
They had perms and I don't know what they were talking about in that hairdressing room, but there was a lot of hilarity going on in there. I mean, I can imagine now, but when I was little, I couldn't imagine. But there was lots of laughter and tears and, you know, they adored her. I think. You know, she was someone really. She understood people, my mum, and she, you know, when we were young, she used to go into nursing homes and do people, you know, the old ladies here in nursing homes, and we were all like, she used to make us go. I was like, Mum, you know, do we have to go? I don't want to go. They're smelly and, you know, all that. And she'd be like, you know, not only do you have to go, but you have to hug them.
Yeah, pull your head in.
Yeah. Because we are the only people that might be touching these people.
Oh.
We are the only people. And so she understood the necessity for physical contact. So she understood that that's what was happening in those exchanges. They were getting their hair washed. Somebody was talking to them. So it was not about the hairdo at all. And so in that way, she was a remarkable teacher. You know, I remember at her funeral, my brother told this story about her, which really does tell about her. He said, you know, he came home from work one day and my mother walked in the back door and she told him this incredible story about this woman and her life and what had happened to her. And my brother was sitting there and he was going, oh, my gosh, Mum, you know, who is that woman? How long have you known that woman? And my mother said, oh, I just met her on the bus, you know. So that's who she was.
There's obviously a bit of her in you. Did you get that from her or from school or from what?
Oh, look, I went to quite a remarkable school. I think I do get that from her, and I think, but I did go to a remarkable school. I went to a Catholic girls' school called St. Ursula's at Kingsgrove, where the nuns were really committed to social justice, actually, and really, you know, understood. I mean, the motto there was Serviam, so they really understood what about service they wanted. They were like, we were their girls, we were going to do stuff. Really, they wanted us to do stuff.
Australian nuns are the kind of at the absolute heart of the generation of second wave Australian feminism.
They absolutely are. They were feminists. They were like, whatever you do, don't get married before you're 30. Like, you know, they were like,
the Pope would approve of
that. No, but I mean, I think they really did. They understood what they were doing with us, and so I left school, and I know other people I went to school with left school with an idea that we needed to do something in the world. But not only that we needed to do something in the world, that we could do something in the world, which are two different things, actually, to feel like you need to do something and to feel able to do something, I think, are two different things. So they really helped us do that.
When you were 18, there was a harrowing incident with you, and it changed the way you see the world and gave you another sense of what to do with your life. What can you tell me about that incident, Jenny?
Look, that was pretty, it was sort of, I was raped, I was kidnapped and raped. And but I think before that had happened to me, I'd been sitting with a friend and she had told me about when she had been raped, and she had said that she understood that when she was raped, she had sort of had a tampon in, and she flung the tampon out and she went, you didn't actually get me. Like, but not, it was not even that. It was much more about the fact that you can, that if someone rapes you, they're not, it's not about you, and it's not, they're not destroying you. So I went into that, which was like a light turning on in my head, because I hadn't thought that before. So I didn't know that was going to happen to me. But when I went into that experience, I knew, I had that knowledge. I had a different perception about what was going to...
Did it make you kind of... You're saying it sort of made you psychologically impregnable?
It made me...
Or defensible anyway.
Well, I think I just thought, I don't know. I really don't know. But I just knew that I had this thing like then... I'm not that. I can't be destroyed by this. It's not going to destroy me. And that was very incredibly helpful. And also, you know, it was really hard. It was a very hard time. But also, I think the thing, I thought they were going to kill me, and I worked very hard for that not to happen. And in some level, I found my own magnificence in that. And I think that was also surprising to me. That was really surprising. But when the other thing is, when you think you're going to die, something inside of you wakes up. And so that combination of all of those things took me a long time to process all of those things. But that experience was life-changing in all of those ways of how you come out of it and what and who you are and what the power is people have over you.
What was it that you think was woken up?
I think it was this idea that, well, my own mortality, the idea that I could die, actually, that life is limited, which is really the great thing about being around death, actually. But if you wake up that, oh, life is limited, so what am I going to do? You know, I can see that in retrospect, but also at the time I had to work really hard to process what had happened. And doing that was helpful. For me.
Why were you, do you think, directed towards community groups rather than, for instance, becoming rich or the CEO of some corporation or something like that?
I don't know. That's a good question. It hasn't even occurred to me to be a CEO of a corporate organisation. Probably I think that people are pretty magnificent. I think human beings have got incredible capacity. And if you work with them and empower them and give them a bit of space, you know, they do remarkable things. And I'm interested in that. I'm interested in those spaces where people rise up and do stuff. You know, it's a very creative space, the community space. And I think I've always been interested in social justice. So I'm interested in people.
Do you still have the voices of those nuns in your ear?
Oh, I do, because they... Those bloody nuns. Well, I mean, I do, but I also know that I've seen it so many times that if you just allow the space and you give encouragement and you allow people to speak and have their ideas and make mistakes, and I wouldn't even call them mistakes, they're just like learnings, and you just see people...
give you their best self.
They do give you their best self.
This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski and Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
First job was at Ronald McDonald House, wasn't it, Jenny?
It wasn't my first job, but it was probably the first job in this field, So I was... one of the managers of Ronald McDonald House at Camperdown Children's
Hospital. Was this the 70s or the 80s or thereabouts?
It was in the
80s. So this is a period when was it still kind of a radical idea that families should live alongside their kids who have cancer?
I don't know, actually. I mean, I know that used to be that people would just, I think it was a long time before the 70s, but I actually don't know, but I know that what used to happen is that children used to be dropped off at the reception of the hospital, and then their parents would just come back and pick them up after they'd, you know,
had a chemotherapy appointment or something.
Well,
right?
You know, when any children, and that's how the medical system did work. And then it was started to be realized that wasn't such a great idea. Mm. Probably also it's very expensive to have to care for all of those children, you know, but. I mean, I met a woman at the Children's Hospital who grew up in the Children's Hospital. She was in her 70s at the time, but she had polio, so she lived there when she was little. So I think part of the setting up of Ronald McDonald House was a realisation that children needed their parents, and that probably more than that, that doctors sort of needed their parents, which has been a part of that progression that's happened through parents being there. I think now doctors do really listen to what the parents are saying, because in my day, when I was there in the 80s, it'd be like the parents would come in and they would say, I had to go to four doctors to get a diagnosis because I would say something's wrong with my child and I wasn't being listened to. But that's really changed now. So there's been a big progression in health around that. But yeah, Ronald McDonald House, it was at Camperdown, it was in Children's Hospital, beautiful old building. Beautiful old house.
My understanding is in those situations very often one of the most distressing things for the kid is this awful worry that by being so dangerously ill they've caused needless worry and distress to their parents. And can I make mum and dad happy? Is that your experience?
Look, with really little children, I think the thing about children is that they manage things. They don't know necessarily... That's not how things are supposed to be. So in lots of ways, they get on with it. They have their treatment, they get on with it. I think that to have their parents be distressed for any child about anything is absolutely difficult for them. So the happier the parents are, or the happier the carer of any child, the happier the child. So I think that's true. I think if you've got parents that are empowered, and also I think, you know, we used to... sort of run mini assertiveness training courses there where we'd be like saying, just ask lots of questions. And people did ask lots of questions. So I do think that it's a very important bond to have. And also that when your child's sick, parents want to sleep in that bed with that child. You know, they want to listen, they want to be with them. So I think it's very beneficial, actually.
For a while, you worked with pregnant teenagers in the western suburbs of Sydney.
Yes.
What was it like having conversations with these young women?
That was really my most difficult job, I have to say, because they...
Really? More difficult than...
It was much more difficult. Yeah, really? It was more difficult because these young women, I mean, it was like almost like feminism hadn't really reached out there. And so a lot of those young women would talk about... sex in a way that was really, they would say, you know, things like, well, my boyfriend would just get on top of me and do his business. Like, that's how they spoke about it. I was like, oh, don't tell me you've got pregnant and you haven't even enjoyed it. For me, really?
So you had to sit down and go,
I had to sit right. I did have to sit down. We did. Anyway, it was all in, I don't know how much I can say on the radio.
There's a few interesting educational
There was some diagrams there. And some fluorescent highlighter pens used. Let's just say we've got them to colour in the important things.
Right. And when she told these girls, what were they like? Were they going, God?
No, I think they just didn't believe me, really. I don't know that. I think they thought I was a bit... I don't know. But the thing was, it was really an interesting place to work because, you know, when you're living in Sydney, I was living in Glebe at the time and I thought everybody
knew.
Mm. Right. And everybody and women were understanding, wanting to be empowered and, you know, but I just had to go to the western suburbs, not very far away in demographics of people that were probably poorer or not as highly educated, and that
or
hadn't
in migrant families where such things are not discussed.
Well, it just hadn't really reached there for no reason. I don't know why. I was more shocked by that, I think. So that was, yeah, it was sort of difficult, really, you know. And then I worked with parents who were finding it difficult to manage their children, and that was difficult as well because the thing about when Ronald McDonald House is that there's so much love and so much attention is given, and to some other children that's not the case, you know, they are loved but the care that they're given is not optimal sometimes, and I think so. I suppose I became really aware of the difference that people were really if you got sick somehow you were good and deserving. But if you were just a person struggling, somehow, maybe, I don't know, there wasn't as much attention going there to those people, those young people. So it was quite, it was challenging. And I really became interested in how to work with probably people who were more disadvantaged at that point. Yeah, because of that.
So you went to Port Kembla, the community centre, to become the manager there. Were you warned off from going to Port Kembla, industrial town with cyclic unemployment, that kind of thing?
Well, I had no idea. I mean, I really didn't have any idea. Even I took the job and I had no idea how much it paid. And then I found out how much it paid and I was like, oh, my God.
Can't live on that.
Can't live on that. Right. I just didn't know. But again, look, I suppose I'm not I haven't had a formal education. I've had a life education. So I'm often the least educated person in a room as far as book learning goes. And so I was like, oh, yeah, you know, I'd never done community development before, but I had Ronald McDonald House was a beautiful learning ground for community development. And so all those other jobs were, so was the what we could teach the young women in community about life and what they could learn off each other. Was a really great learning experience for me.
So sometimes community centres can be kind of sad and perfunctory places that aren't really used by the community. How did you get it up and running?
Well, when I wasn't allowed to open the front door of the community centre when I first started because Port Kembla was like the centre of the street sex industry and had quite difficult, big issues with drug and alcohol and mental health issues, and then nobody on the main street and I wasn't allowed to, so I got this job and then I wasn't allowed to open the front door. So I just had to sit on the front steps and smoke cigarettes and give cigarettes to people and hope they'd talk to me. And they did talk to me. And gradually we worked out what we were going to do there. And so I again didn't know what I didn't know. And we had a big meeting. One of the laneways. We called a big meeting and we just asked the community what they wanted. And we went around the whole community and they just had to say what they wanted. And the rule was you have to say what you want, then everyone has to clap, you know. And anyway, people said all different things. Said, you know, I want to live in a community where, you know, it's clean, and I want to live in a community where there's not syringes on the ground. I want to live in, you know, the kids were like, I want to live in a community where there's lollies given away. And anyway, all these stuff, you know, and I was like, I want to live in that community where there's lollies given away. Yeah. Anyway, in the end, we got round to the end of the circle and this old woman said, this very simple thing. I want to live in the community where people ask you how you are and then they stop to listen. And then everyone said, oh, we want to live in that community. And it was like, and that's all we did. We didn't really do anything else, but we had this.
Simple act of the imagination there.
Yeah,
that's all it is.
It is. It's like going, okay, so we're saying, okay, that's the culture you want. Go and do it. So from that, we really decided that we would have a sort of, we weren't going to have clients, that we'd have a citizen-based sort of philosophy where people were responsible for creating the culture. I mean, the culture is simply the way we do things around here. And so who's responsible for that? Well, we are. Everyone is.
I get the impression that the men's group you have there is a really big deal.
Yeah, it's a really big deal. They're really, the men's group are, you know, they have Daniel Dayton, a local man, started that men's group, and he had this idea that men wanted to do things that were of meaning in the community. And so he formed that group, and he's a permaculture gardener, so he did that around a lot of permaculture principles. But basically what it is just these blokes that get together and they all do things they like to do. They cook, they support each other, they play chess, they fix things. They fix things very often for me at Tender. And they are, they're great. They just really, they run themselves. I mean, I don't really run them.
Yeah. Are they by and large unemployed or retired? Men or
retired? Retired and unemployed. Right. Yeah.
So that meant it's a way for them to be helpful and also to find honour and dignity, I suppose, through that.
I think it's also just a place for them, that's their place, you know, that they can come and do. Because often you go out there and they are somewhat, like, they're not like doing a whole lot of talking. Someone's doing one thing and they're just being with each other, but they're all doing stuff. Mm. So it's a different thing to when women get together. It's like, it's a different...
It's talking while doing, is
that it? Or even not even talking, just being together and, you know, passing tools. And then they all have lunch together and they have a big yarn at lunch, you know. But it's really lovely. It is lovely the way they work together. And you know, and they look after the grounds at the community centre. And, you know, when we ask them to do things, they will do them if they can, which is great.
You started a festival there.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. What did you learn from that process of starting a festival and making it into a success?
Well, I think what we learned, we started a festival. The area we live in was really it's an area where there's a lot of people who have got no money to go anywhere. So they don't even, you know, they don't have much to do in some ways. And even though there's some great things in our community, sometimes people don't think that those things are for them. And so, you know, so there's a...
Like what? What do you mean?
Well, like, we've got a great swimming pool there. And I remember when I first started working there, I would say to people, there's a great swimming pool down there. Why don't you go swimming? They'd say, that's not for us. So there's a whole lot of things about belonging that are really important. So you've got to not only think that, you know, you've got to be able to feel like that you're entitled to something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that down around there's some super expensive beachfront properties.
There are some very super, but there's also people living on the street. So that's a very, and there's a big Aboriginal community there. So it's a very diverse area. There's a lot of money. There's no money. There's homelessness. There's, you know, very diverse community. So there's a lot of diversity. And also Port Kembla, was really like a place that had a lot of stigma attached to it. You know, it's like a place where the prostitutes and, you know, really a lot of stigma attached to it. So people, so we needed to try and build pride in the community. And what was, so we did this, you know, community development usually should ask people, what do you want to do? And we should all talk about it. But we decided that we would do the first festival ourselves as a group of workers. And we did a festival based on a 13th century Persian poem called Conference of the Birds, which was about bringing, because there's a beautiful lagoon there, and we did a thing where we bought we wanted to bring the spirit back to the community. So we built this.
See, I was thinking, you know, you put a festival on Port Kembla, make it somehow about steel, I suppose. No. I don't know. And you went, a 13th century Persian poem about birds.
It's like, so then we built this big bird, like it was a big lantern that everyone called the chalk, which, you know, it's like. But, and we did this thing with the kids where they walked, where they was all had all their, they were like painted like ghosts actually, and they did a lantern walk, and in the middle of the lantern walk was this huge thunderstorm. It was like, I was sitting there going, oh my God, you know, please don't let anyone get hurt. Everybody, nobody left. Everybody waited for these children to come. And these children, when they walked out of that bush, it was like they'd just been born. They were so happy because they'd been through this quite scary experience, right? And they were okay. And everybody there cheering them, and they all sat, they all came and sat around. We did the big lantern thing, and we had these five cooking fires, and from the different communities, you know, we had kangaroo and javapi and all the different meats from the different ethnic groups. And so people went away, and some people said that was the best thing I've ever been to in my life, right, which is a worry. So I was like, no, that can't be true, you know. But what happened was the next year we said, okay, we're not going to do it this year. What do you want to do in the community? And the Aboriginal community said, we want to do the story of the first death. And so we did the Birth of the Butterfly story. So it became that sort of festival. And we didn't invite anybody. Like we said, this, we're not inviting anybody else. This is for our community.
So your role then is to, you stand in the middle of a very big tent, invite everyone in and ask them what use they want to make of the tent. Something like that.
Something, really. Well, you know, it's about showing, it's about possibility.
Yeah.
And about
imagination.
Mm. Imagination, and about saying, what do you want to do and how are we going to do that? And what is that going to, how are we going to do that together? And we did do quite a lot of things together in that festival. And in the end, the last festival we did there, people were wanting to come from outside. They're like, what are you doing down there? That looks so great what you're doing. And we were like, for the first few times, well, the first festival we did actually, we built a bread oven in a park. That was the first festival. We built a bread oven in a park and we did a big baking festival. And the next one was that other one, the Conference of the Birds. But, you know, in the end, it was like we went, okay, we're going to invite everybody else. And then we said, let's come. And that then was about the pride. And the community was like, felt, you know, happy that they could show something off about their community. We did one about bringing the black swan. We did one about the black swans because there hadn't been black swans on the lagoon. And funnily enough, they came back, the black swans, after that. It was like the next day after that festival, they were black swans. And we were like, we didn't think they were. I was like, oh, I didn't think they'd really come.
But I didn't know there were black swans on the east coast of Australia.
Yes, there were black swans on that lagoon. So that, who knows? I don't know, but it's, yeah, it was pretty great, actually.
So, Jenny, you then had the idea to set up a not-for-profit funeral service in Port Kembla through the community centre. Tell me how you went about finding a suitable premises for your not-for-profit funeral centre.
Well, there was a fire station around the corner, owned by the local bread company there, Falcone's, and they, and I knew I needed a building that you could drive a vehicle into.
Oh, of course, right.
So the fire station seemed like a perfect building for that. But we didn't have any money. I mean, for a long time we didn't have any money, and which was the beauty of the film, really. I mean, I wrote a lot of grant applications and, you know, everyone said no. The Trust Foundation actually did fund me in Zenith to do an education program around New South Wales about that. But so Lynette Walworth, who made the film, who's really an extraordinary, my oldest friend, but also an extraordinary artist, she said to me, I think what we have to do is make a film. And I was like, well, that's going to be an interesting film because it's going to be me sitting at my desk writing grant applications that people reject. It's like I had no idea what we could film. But she said, no, we were going to make a film. And the first, and so we didn't know then Nigel wasn't sick. And so what, so in a way that whole, he found out he was sick 2 weeks before we started that filming.
This is Nigel, the caretaker of the community centre.
So, and so we filmed that process. But honestly, it was really, the reason in the end really we did get the funding was because we did a crowdfunding campaign from based on the back of seeing people seeing that film, and people sent us money that was like $5 in from all around the country. $5 wrapped up in a handwritten letter to a $30,000 singular donation. People got behind the idea. And then Vincent Fairfax, extraordinary foundation, actually, because they I'm a Vincent Fairfax fellow, but so they really are the best funders, because they said, yes, we will fund you. And CIFA, who's a Social Enterprise Finance Australia, said, yes, we will fund you. If Vincent Fairfax does, then we'll give
matching
you a
funding,
loan.
Right.
So, well, we got a loan. So we had a loan. We got a big grant from Vincent Fairfax, and the community gave us money. And that's how we got the fire station. And Falcone's basically waited for us to get the money together to do it, which was good.
If you do have a not-for-profit funeral, if someone chooses to do that, is it more affordable? Is it much cheaper?
It's much cheaper. It's much cheaper because we just, I mean, we're in a privileged position in that we just charge what it costs. So we have to, we're paying off our loan, so that's part of what it costs. Yes, it is cheaper because we don't have to distribute a profit. So it is cheaper for people, yeah.
Does it take time for people to get used to the idea and to become involved with the preparation of the body?
I think we have about 40% of people coming into the mortuary now, which is pretty. Amy, who's our funeral director, said, you know, in her experience, 1-2% of people come into the mortuary, so that's pretty good. And I think what we do is we offer a continual choice to people. We say to people, you know, would you like to come in and help us wash and dress someone? And they would, sometimes people go, yes, I really, they know they want to do it. Other times they're like, oh, no, I don't think so. And we go, that's okay if you change your mind, you know, and we get a phone call. I was thinking about what you were saying, and then they come, and then the sisters come. And but it's a thing really about saying not everybody has to do, not everybody, if you want to do it and your sister doesn't, you can still do it.
Yeah,
so it's about opening a very big space, the whole thing actually. So it's, the whole thing is about saying we can do what you'd like and what you'd like. And what you'd like. So, I mean, once we had two funerals for the same person because the family wanted a very religious service and the other part of the family didn't, so we just did two funerals.
One of the things that's often galling about the funeral process is the coffin. The idea that you spend all this money on some garish thing that looks like a grandfather clock, essentially, you know, to bury your loved one in seems, you know, I don't know, do you have a view on that?
Look, I have a view on the cost, the cost of coffins in traditional, you know, commercial funeral homes. But I think funerals are mostly what people want is value. Mostly what people want is just for things to be fair. So the coffins, we have woven wicker coffins, and we have cardboard coffins, and we have just the traditional coffins.
I would encourage people to decorate their own coffins.
Oh, yeah, people write on the coffins, or, you know, we've dropped coffins off and people have carried their coffins on their roof racks down, you know, down the Pacific Highway, Little Princess Highway to us. And
gee, I hope that's properly strapped on.
Oh, I think it is probably, because people would be quite horrified, wouldn't they? Anyway, I think it's, I think coffins, the thing is wrapping people and putting them in their coffin in a loving way is important.
And how about you have a thing called a cold plate?
We do have a cold plate.
Which allows people to have the dead person
at home
for how long?
Can keep somebody at home for up to 5 days. So the cold plate is just like a metal plate, and it's got a little refrigeration unit near it, and that's, it just keeps the body cold.
And what does that do for people, do you tend to find?
Look, I think people who want to do that really love it, and they just gives them time. Like, it gives them time. No matter, the thing is, when someone's died, you need to go from the point where someone's died to the point where you dispose of their body, and that's a process. And so after a few days of somebody having someone at home, people will say, I need to dispose of this body now, and they're ready, rather than it being an invisible thing. Where, so I think for people it gives them a sort of time to get familiar with it, you know. We have and also to watch what happens with somebody. And sometimes, you know, people ring us up and they'll say, you know, they'll say, oh, in that 3 days, they usually check in, you know, how's it going? They go, oh, good, she looks very relaxed today. Or,
you know, really? Like that, yeah, they notice changes from day to day?
You know, they do. Right. And then, you know, one guy one day rang up and said, oh, she's got a smile on her face now because the body relaxes. And that's a reassurance for people. It just gives people time. That's all. Is what it does is gives people time, and it reveals the process of what happens when someone dies, and it's actually quite a gentle.
Oh, it's a gentle process. It's not like ripping off a band-aid.
No.
No. How amazing speaking with you, Jenny. This is an amazing story. There's so much to be understood from this process. I really appreciate you coming in and telling your story today. Thank you.
Thank you for talking to me.
On ABC Radio, you're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. Podcast, broadcast, and online. Subscribe to our free podcast service. Details on our website, abc.net.au/conversations.
I spoke to Jenny Briscoe-Huff in February. Who have we got on tomorrow, Sarah?
Richard, it is the true and terrifying tale of the taipan.
Aren't they the most deadly snakes in the history of the world, those snakes? Don't they really hurt if they bite you?
They really, really, really hurt. And some mad, brave, foolhardy Australians had to go and find the anti-venom. And that's the story we'll hear tomorrow on this week of Glorious Conversations.
I'm Richard Feidler.
I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.